of Hero Hype, episode 33. I'm back. Yes, I kind of went away for a week, but I'm done storming castles. No, really, I did actually go to a castle and climb through the ruins like an Avenger. But I'm back and ready to talk about the majority of the mid-season finales. We obviously didn't get Supergirls this week, but that will be soon, Monday soon. But as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Caitlin.
Hello.
And if you guys want to get involved in the conversation and chat to us, you can do so by contacting us on Twitter, which is at Hero Hype Podcast. Leave a comment on this post when it goes up on Hyperbole.com, or send us an email, which is HeroHypePodcast@gmail.com. Are you glad to have me back, Caitlin?
Oh, so excited.
One whole week apart. How did you cope?
I was having massive withdrawals. That's true.
No, I was the one having withdrawals. I still edited the episode, but every couple of, like, minutes, I was, like, wanting to jump in and talk about things. It was, yeah, it was intense. Not being able to talk about the episodes last week, painful. Caitlin got all of my Facebook messages, though.
And there were a lot.
There were a lot. I did inundate her a little bit. But hopefully you guys enjoyed having new voices and familiar voices in the last episode. I know I really enjoyed having Kristen on, so if you liked having her on too, let us know, because I would love to have her back and actually get a chance to chat with her. But let's get right into it, because obviously a lot happened in these mid-season finales. So we're going to get things kicked off with a brief history. Yep, it's back. And this week I've got a brief history of Martian Manhunter. So, Jean was born one of twins, an uncommon occurrence in Martian culture. While Jean had all of the abilities of the Martian race, his brother was unable to communicate telepathically. Jean grew up to become a manhunter, a Martian police officer, and married a Martian woman called Mariah, with whom he had a daughter. Jean's brother despised everything about the Martians and engineered a virus to commit full-scale genocide. The virus reacted to the Martians' telepathic energy and preyed on their fear of fire, causing intense stress, which led to them bursting into flames. Jean lost both his wife and daughter, but was saved from the same fate when he was inexplicably teleported away. Saul Erdl, a would-be scientist on Earth, was responsible for bringing Jean to the planet. He nursed him back to health, but when Jean used his shape-shifting abilities, Erdl was so shocked that he had a heart attack and died. Jean kept his human-like appearance and adopted the name John Jones. Great undercover name there. Joining the police force and keeping the peace before later going on to become a founding member of the Justice League. So, yeah, shock of all shocks. I was not expecting to be seeing Martian Manhunter at any point in Supergirl, I will admit. But that's why we're telling you a little bit about his background.
And if you read the Who is Martian Manhunter article on Hypable, there are some quotes from the people behind Supergirl telling us a little bit about what we can expect from Jean moving forward. And it sounds really great, kind of about how it's going to be kind of this adoptive family with Jean and Alex and Kara. And sounds really great.
Oh, I'm so ready for it. I really am. It was like my least expected thing to happen, and the second it did, I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. I am here for it.
I was so excited when he started being like, you know, Hank Henshaw died. I was like, wait, is he Martian Manhunter? And then he's like, I'm the last of my race. I was like, oh my god, he's Martian Manhunter. And then he changed, and I think I made a very loud squealing noise.
Yeah, yeah, we now know where the budget went. That meant that Red Tornado looked like a Power Ranger villain, and and Jean looked awesome, like seriously awesome. And that looming shot where he gets really tall, ugh. Okay, we'll leave that for the actual recap, though, because I have so many great feelings about it. But do we want to just really quickly go over the news that we got for TV?
We have very, very quick news for the TV side with everything going into its finales for now. We got a little bit of casting for The Flash. They have cast Tone Bell. He's a comedian. He's going to be playing Iris's new boss at Central City Picture News. His name is going to be Scott Evans, which is not a familiar name, so it looks like it'll be an original character. They're saying he is devoted to hard journalism and will push Iris and all his reporters to dig deeper into their stories and report the truth about what's really happening in Central City. And he's going to be in several episodes. So I feel like being an editor at CCPN is like being a politician in Star City. Like, they don't have long lifespans. So they have should to be keep worried. Casting them. This is not the first. Iris has lost more than one boss at this point, so she's like on her third boss at this job.
I'm looking forward to seeing him come in, though, because the fact that he's really into like hard journalism stuff could mean that we'll start seeing like a lot more investigative stuff about the weird crap that's happening, because, you know, there's only so much that you can like walk past and be like, la la la, everything's normal, everything's fine, nothing to see here, move along.
So it sounds like Iris's role is gonna pick up in the second half of the season, which is good because she hasn't had a ton to do in the first half. But with the introduction of Wally, which we'll talk about, and a new boss, sounds like there should be more for her to do, which is exciting.
Yeah, definitely exciting. Looking forward to seeing more West family interactions.
Yes. All right, and our other piece of TV news is also casting, this time for Supergirl. Italia Ricci will be playing Silver Banshee, aka Siobhan Smythe, which, for those of you who listen to Glee Chat, you know my love of Sebastian Smythe, played by Grant Gustin. So I was just like, in my brain, they're like siblings now. But she's being described as Cat Grant's latest hire, who at first becomes a work nemesis for Kara, but she later proves a more deadly foe for Supergirl when she takes on the mantle of DC Comics villain Silver Banshee. So that's a character who is established in the DC Comics, so they're pulling that in.
I now just have this, like, ridiculous Glee AU where, like, Sebastian leaves and takes on a new name and becomes, what have you done to me? You're the worst. Oh my god, Caitlin. This is terrible.
I have so much love for Sebastian. I can't help it. So then I see that name and I'm just like, and then Grant is also the Flash, and it just all works in my head somehow.
Yeah, no, it's also working in my head. I was a huge Sebastian Smythe fan. Like, we're not gonna get into my feelings about Sebastian Smythe because it will literally derail the whole episode. It will be terrible.
This is not Glee Chat.
No, this is not Glee Chat, but I loved Sebastian. I have a lot of feelings about him. If you want to come talk about Sebastian Smythe and Glee with me, find me on my personal Twitter, which is virtual_Don. And in fact, Cece and Caitlin as well, because I'm pretty sure we'll probably have a lot of the same feelings about Sebastian. But yes, now my head is on this massive, ridiculous Glee AU mashing up with The Flash. Thanks for that. Yeah.
It's there. It's necessary. But she's going to show up first in episode 14, which we're getting because Supergirl got its full season order. So, yay!
And again, another female villain, female character, female villains, female good guys, female in-between characters. I'm really here for everything being really female-heavy. Like, it's great. I'm absolutely loving it.
Me too.
All the ladies. Oh, that's it. That's all the TV news. So, where would we like to start?
Well, that transitions pretty well. Shall we just go into Supergirl?
Yeah, sure. Let's go with it.
All right, so this was Human for a Day, and the kind of central conceit of this episode is that after her fight with Red Tornado, Kara burned herself out with her powers, and the DEO tries to help her recharge, and it's no-go, and they're saying, you know, Superman usually takes about 48 hours when this happens to him, and she's past that, so she's starting to worry a bit that maybe her powers aren't gonna come back at all, and Kara gets to enjoy all the things about being human, like catching a cold on the bus on her way to work, and taking the bus to work, and all that good stuff. So, she is sent home from work, because Cat Grant can't have her assistant being sick because she'll cause a recession, apparently. And so when she's on her way home, she meets Jimmy because... or James, because of course you do. And then because the universe knows the city doesn't have its superhero, there's an earthquake. Of course there is!
Basically, everything bad that could happen did happen, but as, like, convenient as a lot of the stuff was in regard to, like, this stuff happening when Kara didn't have her powers, a lot of shows that have characters that have some kind of other power, like, they do typically have the hero loses their powers for a day kind of episode. I think this is one of the more successful ones, though. I thought it tackled it in a really interesting way, and just, it was really, really heartbreaking at points. It, like, really, 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 really was, like, hard on my heart. I was like, oh god. When you think the show can't get more emotional, it does.
Yeah, and one of those moments was them having to watch that guy die from internal bleeding.
Yeah, that was horrible. Because the thing with that is that if you stop and think about it for a second, even if Kara had her powers, like, internal bleeding is not necessarily something her superpowers would have been able to help with anyway. Even if she'd managed to, like, rescue him, it, you know, internal bleeding is kind of one of those things that, you know, rescuing someone isn't gonna fix immediately. So just her feeling more powerless, it was so good. It was just so well done. It was horrible, but it was so well done.
Yeah, it was really great. And she gets her support in this episode from James. And this really felt like a building block episode for their relationship. They have some really great exchanges. There's the first one after the guy dies and James is saying, you know, heroes don't save everybody. It's just impossible to do, but they always keep trying. And it's this really sweet moment, very supportive. And then that inspires Kara to go stop a looter, even though she doesn't have powers. And it's this really great moment of her kind of being like, well, he doesn't know I don't have powers. So she basically talks this guy down from robbing a convenience store, and he ends up giving her the gun. And it's this really heroic moment, and James gets it on film and later gives the picture to Kara. And it's really a beautiful moment. I thought it was really kind of transformative for Kara, because up until this point, she's been relying so heavily on her powers, and this time she can't. She only has herself to fall back on. So moving forward, having gotten her powers back, she's going to be able to draw on that experience and not have to just rely on the powers that she's still developing, but be able to draw on that strength she has just as herself, which I think is really important for her.
Yeah, it just kind of emphasized the fact that what makes her a hero is what comes from within. It's who she is as a person, not what she can do as a person. And it just, this is what made this storyline in particular so successful. Whereas a lot of the time with this kind of human for a day storyline, they try and make it, like, humorous, kind of, oh, isn't it ridiculous now that they're actually human, like, they can't deal with anything sort of storyline. But this actually really broke down that she's never known anything other than having these powers and being almost invulnerable to a lot of things that people on Earth are vulnerable to, like catching colds, like being able to be mortally wounded by something like an earthquake or a gunshot. And it really hit home who she is and who she wants to be as a hero. And it was just beautiful. It was just so well done. And I was so impressed with this episode. Like, I've really enjoyed this since the start, since its pilot episode. But I really feel like now the story is finding its feet and it's really tightening up the narrative a lot more, and it's really getting into some good stuff. Even the episode last week, as much as our resident Power Ranger was kind of, the look of him kind of kept throwing me off, that was also a really solid episode that I was incredibly impressed with. So yeah, I'm hoping the strength of these storylines continues. because I'm really, really liking where they're going with everything.
Yeah, I agree. I've really enjoyed everything up until this point, but it does feel like as enjoyable as everything has been, it's finding its stride. Now that things have started to kind of click into place, it's like everything's kind of, now we know who's who and how the pieces work together, and now they can really start building on themselves, which has been enjoyable to watch. So one of my favorite scenes in this episode that I just want to talk about for a minute was after Kara talks the looter down and James kind of prints out the picture of her talking him down, they have this really lovely, intimate discussion about, you know, how he got into photography, why he loves it. He tells her about his father and that his father gave him his first camera and then he died in the first Gulf War, which is a little bit more backstory on him, and they kind of end up hugging, which there's a moment in the look ahead trailer that looks like it was cut from this scene where like Kara says like, I don't want to let go, and James says neither do I, which looks like it was cut from the actual scene in the episode, which is too bad because it was sweet. But I don't know, I really enjoyed this exchange. You see how comfortable they are with each other and how close they have gotten in this relatively short time of knowing each other, and James is revealing some personal things about himself, and Kara like says the exact right things, like he shows her the picture of his father and she just says, you know, you look like him, which, you know, I think she knows what he needed to hear and he knows what she needs to hear, so their dynamic is just strengthening a lot, and I really loved that scene. What about you?
Yeah, no, I really loved it as well. It's great when we get, like, they don't need to, this is the thing with, like, backstories and stuff. You don't need big flashbacks and you don't need big moments that kind of dive really, really far into it. Small little moments like that, that capture what someone's upbringing was like, is enough to build an idea of where those characters came from, as an entire flashback episode can, if you're smart with them. And this was a really, really smart moment because it kind of lends meaning to a bigger part of James's life. And it was just perfect. I absolutely loved it. And just the dynamic between the two of them, again, regardless of where they may or may not end up, I love their friendship. I think it's really easy. They get each other. You know, James has devoted so much of his time to Superman, and that he's learning more being with Kara in whatever that means. You know, this is what I'm really loving, is seeing them grow as characters together. You know, yes, I'm really enjoying the dynamic, and I think the chemistry between the two of them is like off the charts for me. But yeah. I honestly, regardless, I would be happy with them remaining friends, just because I just like seeing them interact together. But this moment was perfect. And while I think you're right that the bit from the trailer was the I don't want to let go and blah 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 moment, I get if that was cut from this scene, I get why they did it. Like, I think in regards to that scene, less was more. And I think it was really nicely done, just the way that we saw it on the screen. So
yeah, I wouldn't have known anything was missing from that, except that it was in the trailer.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this scene, I'm going to jump a little bit around, but this scene, they get their hug, which is, I didn't see anything necessarily wrong with this hug. It was just, they're having this close moment. They just had a very emotional experience with the robbery, and it's supportive and friends can hug each other. But the moment's interrupted by Wynn, who did exactly in this episode what I was afraid they were going to do with him. And they turned him into that guy, the nice guy. He interrupts the hug and they both look a little guilty, but there wasn't really anything going on. It's not like he caught them making out. They were hugging in an emotionally supportive moment, and he's clearly flustered and upset because he has feelings for Kara, and he tells them that Kara needs some kind of adrenaline rush to get her powers back. And then later, he's really cold to Kara. Like, you can't have him. He has a girlfriend, which, you know, he's not wrong about that. James is in a relationship, but his tone is very nasty. And it's clear that his motivations are very much out of jealousy and the fact that Kara has never been interested in him in that way. And then this other guy comes in and within weeks, like, is having these close, intimate moments with his best friend who he's been in love with for years. And it just... They're going there. I think they're going there, Danya.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking that comment that we got an episode or two back that was talking about this potentially being the motivation for him going off the rails and maybe it being his villain origin story might not be far wrong if this episode's any indicator. Because I get that some people are still going to root for this as a relationship. I get it. There are a lot of us have been in love with a friend. The thing that he needs to realize, though, is that I think Kara's aware of it. She just isn't willing to address or reciprocate it. And taking that into account, you know, you've got to be willing to step away and preserve your friendship over anything else. I mean, it's not the thing with love is that it's not forced. You can't force it. I mean, there are a lot of storylines that tackle, and there's been a whole series tackling when you try and force a relationship. Jessica Jones. But yeah, it's just one of those things where it's like I've been nice guy'd by so many people who just because they'll get close to me, they'll be friends with me for ages and ages and ages, and because they do nice things for me and because they support me emotionally, they then expect something in return. And that expecting something in return isn't the same kind of support and friendship that they've extended to me. It's some kind of romantic relationship, and you can't force those feelings. And I really am getting really uncomfortable with it because it's hitting so close to home with how so many guys have treated me. It's not that we don't appreciate what those guys do for us. It's just that those feelings, they're not always going to be there. They're not always going to be reciprocated. And it's what you do next that defines you as a person. If you start then turning it on that woman, on us as women, to it being our fault, and you start getting aggressive about it, that's when there's a major problem. And this seems to be the direction that they're going with Wynn, and it's making me incredibly uncomfortable.
But they have shown such awareness of the issues that they're presenting that I'm sure it's unintentional.
I don't mean uncomfortable in the way that I don't like that they're going in this direction with, and I think it's not being well done. I think it's incredibly well done. The reason it's uncomfortable for me is because it's so close to home in regards to real life. That, like, it's so clear that they are aware that this is how some women have to deal with certain men in their lives, and that's why it's uncomfortable, because I see so much of, like, things that have happened to me in it, and it's, like, it's something that I think needs to be addressed, but it's, yeah, that's why it's uncomfortable, not because I don't think they're doing a good job, just to clarify.
Yeah, I'm just... I think they're going that route on purpose, and that they're gonna perhaps send him down the villain road. I hope it takes a while and it's not just like, oh, she has feelings for James. Dun, 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 villain. Like, let it pan out for a long time. But he's definitely been making me uncomfortable, so, as well. And I think Kara has recognition that he has feelings for her because she immediately realizes, oh, that's bad that he saw this. And later she tries to invite him, like, to hang out. And that's when he's nasty to her. So there's some level of recognition that he has feelings for her with her. And she's trying to kind of soften it as much as she can. And he's not taking it, unfortunately. So we shall see how that plot line pans out. But Kara does get her powers back, surprising nobody. And she gets it from the adrenaline rush that Wynn mentioned when there's another explosion higher up in the building. And so James, Kara, and Wynn go out to the elevator to try to help people. And James climbs up the elevator and gets everybody out. And when he's on his way down, we have the dramatic moment of the elevator cord snapping. And Kara has to, like, her broken arm, she realizes she's making a fist with it. And she flies down as he's falling to his death. And she takes the time to change into her Supergirl outfit as she's flying down to rescue him from certain deaths, but she does save him and then goes and helps around the city. But
quick change.
Yeah, I was like, wait a second. Is she in her costume now? Like, she took the time. Like, I know she's really, really fast, but she still took the time to change into her costume.
Yeah, I was just like, okay. I guess while you're saving people, you have to look fabulous. But I don't know. I actually, it was a really cool little moment because it just, I guess it solidifies the emotional connection between them again. And like I said, regardless of what that means, even them as like a really strong friendship, supportive friendship, like it was really nice to see that be the catalyst for getting her powers back. I just thought it was, yeah, it was another great moment. There were like lots of really quietly beautiful moments. And that was one grand gesture that was nicely set up. So I liked it.
I guess my justification for that is like, what, they're in a public place. So if somebody saw her coming out of the elevator, like flying with James, they'd be like, holy crap, like, aren't you Kat's assistant? So
yeah, that is true. It just, yeah, it's still one of those moments where it's like, oh, you had time to do that though? Like, yeah, I think it's too, I think it's too early for like potential reveal of identity in the season. So yeah, I get that. That's a good justification for why it happened. It was just still, it was a little funny.
Yeah, I was like, wait a second, you don't have a lot of time here. But yeah, the other kind of plot line going on, well, there are a couple. First, Maxwell Lord is taking the opportunity to make himself look good and put Supergirl down, and he is helping everybody, and he reveals that he knows that she doesn't have her powers. James and Kara, as James and Kara go to see him to try and talk him down, and he says that he knows she doesn't have her powers. So he is quite well informed, and I just have to say that he's more of a Lex Luthor than Jesse Eisenberg was in that Batman v Superman trailer.
He really is. Like, he's got more of that quietly sinister edge to him that's kind of bordering, it's bordering between being utterly terrifying and a little hammy at times, but it's, he's walking that line a lot better for me than the little that we got of Jesse Eisenberg in that trailer. I think Jesse Eisenberg, friend of mine, I sent the link to Caitlin earlier in the week, a friend of mine called Andre, who runs a YouTube channel called Black Nerd Comedy, if any of you are familiar with him, did a reaction video to the Batman vs. Superman trailer where he likened Superman, Batman, and Lex to A.C. Slater, Zach Morris, and Screech, respectively. And I'm sorry, but that is probably the most accurate description of the three of them in that trailer that I've seen come out of, like, any of the reactions to it. And I can't get it out of my head. So, yes. Yeah, Maxwell Lord is, like, he's working that line a lot better for me. Obviously, the what we got of Jesse Eisenberg in that trailer was so condensed. It could just be from, like, very particular moments, and it might be better in, like, larger sections, but it was, if that's what, I'm a little worried that that's what he's going to be like through the whole film, and that may be the thing that ruins it for me, and I'm really hoping not, because I actually quite like Lex Luthor as a villain.
But speaking of Maxwell Lord, what do we think his angle is? What is he after? Like, we know he wants to find out more about Kara, but that's kind of all we've gotten, is that he is continually putting her down in the media, but secretly trying to find out, like, who she is. But what else do we think his angle might be? Do we have enough information yet?
I don't think we have enough information yet. They are really teasing this out in a slow build kind of way. And I kind of like that we don't really know what his motivations are yet, because it just builds suspense. And I like that. I like that we don't know immediately. I like that we're having to dig and look for any little clues and any kind of interaction he's had with any character. So I'm hoping maybe we'll get slightly more in the mid-season finale to kind of figure it out. But right now, I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, we don't have a lot, but I am loving Peter Facinelli in this role. I think he's great. And I'm really curious to see where they go with him, because, yeah, I think they're doing a really interesting thing with him. So, and I'm like, I don't get the impression that he like dislikes Supergirl. I think he just is kind of fascinated by her in some way. And I don't know if like the putting her down is a way to like, I don't know, get like draw her out or anything, but I don't know. I think there's some interesting things going on. Plus, he's got this weird dynamic going on with Alex that I'm not sure what to make of yet. And I'm very fascinated by this character at this point.
Yeah, agreed. I can't wait to see a little bit more and try and tease out what they're actually doing with him, but I guess we'll have to wait until we get a little bit more.
But yeah, so we'll come to why we were talking about Martian Manhunter in our brief history. Is that was our big reveal in this episode, was that Hank Henshaw is not Hank Henshaw. When the earthquake strikes, it affects the DEO as well, and one of their captive aliens, Jem, son of Saturn from the comic books, gets loose. He has mind control powers. So it's a whole big thing to try to capture him. But meanwhile, Alex is just not having it with Hank, and Hank has some suspicious things going on around him. So she finally confronts him, and he eventually tells her the truth, that the story that Wynn found, Hank and Jeremiah went in to go find an alien, but what they found was that the alien was friendly, and so Jeremiah wanted just to leave him alone. But Hank Henshaw was like, no, we're going to do this mission. It was a mission to terminate the alien threat. And so there was some kind of conflict, and they both were killed. But our alien made a promise to Jeremiah to look after his daughter. And that alien was the guy wearing Hank Henshaw's face, John Jones, Martian Manhunter.
That scene was phenomenal. Just the conversation between Alex and Jean, and the reveal, and the way that he changes into Jean, and he gets like really imposing and tall, and just, I got chills. I literally got chills. And I was just so impressed, because I'll put my hands up, I didn't see it coming. I didn't even see anyone speculating about it. And I don't know if that's because I wasn't on the right parts of the internet, but it took me by surprise. And bravo Supergirl, because I think it's an incredibly interesting direction to take this show in. It really ups the game as well, because he's a huge character. Huge. And
I'm really surprised that they were allowed to use him, considering the Justice League stuff that's coming up.
I mean, I don't think they're gonna put Jean in the Justice League, though, in the movies.
But, I mean, we only know about the first one so far. If they want to do more, they'd want to leave it open, because he's a founding member of the Justice League.
He is. I don't know if they want... I don't know.
So it seems like they're probably not, but I was thinking about it, I was surprised that they let Supergirl use the character, but then it probably means he won't be in the films.
Yeah, which is, I really like him as a character, so I'm a little disappointed that we might not get him in the movies, but I do like that he's going to be in the TV series of Supergirl, because it's going to give a lot of space to develop him as a character. He's just really fascinating. I love him. So I'm excited to see what they're going to do with him. And yeah, again, now we know why Red Tornado looked like a cheap costume from a costume shop rather than the epic android we were probably expecting. It's because all of the budget went on Jean. And you know what? Fine. It was definitely worth it. Like, that moment, that one moment, was worth the Power Rangers costume.
And they've said, so kind of in that interview where they were talking about what to expect with the character moving forward, we're gonna kind of see flashbacks to the Holocaust on Mars, they've said. And we're also gonna see just kind of Jean developing this kind of, he's very much feeling like a father figure for Alex and Kara, because he made that promise to Jeremiah, and then knowing that he lost his own child on Mars, like, makes that very much even more powerful for him. So, and what I think is funny is that they were saying that when the idea came up, it was kind of started as a joke, that they were kind of looking at David Harewood and being like, he's got those kind of funny big ears. And they were saying, you know, he would be like a perfect Martian Manhunter. Too bad we're not doing Martian Manhunter. And then they kind of went, I mean, and you know, Geoff Johns is involved in all this, so they've got the pull that they need. But they were like, wait, why don't we do Martian Manhunter? So they kind of loved the idea that they already knew that Hank was going to have some kind of secret, but they were going to make it seem sketchy, and then it's going to turn out to actually be this really good secret with, like, the most pure-hearted character in, like, the DC Comics, basically. Ends up being, like, behind the shady-seeming secret. So it kind of started as a joke, and then ended up being like, well, why don't we do this? It's a great idea.
Yeah, and the thing is that if this is the episode before the mid-season finale, and that was such a huge moment, I wonder what they're going to do for their mid-season finale.
Well, we're going to see Astra.
Yes, yeah. But again, that Jean, huge reveal. Now I'm just like, how are they going to top that in a mid-season finale? Like, so I'm really anxious for the next episode. Really anxious.
Yeah. So, amazing reveal. So good. So good. But yeah, any other thoughts on Supergirl this week?
No, I think we're good to move on.
All right, shall we go to The Flash?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, so this was a mid-season finale, and it was kind of more of a one-off. We had kind of opens with Weather Wizard appearing again, and Liam McIntyre is just so very attractive. I just need to get that out there. He's very pretty. But he shows up and breaks Captain Cold and the Trickster out of prison. So guys, we found Luke Skywalker. Everything's good. No need to worry about The Force Awakens. He's fine. He's in Central City.
Yeah, it's all good.
But yeah, so they team up and Weather Wizard's like, I want to kill the Flash because he wants revenge for his brother and all that stuff. And the Trickster wants chaos. So he's like, I'm good. And Captain Cold, not so much. He is like, he pretends to be interested, and then he's like, I'm not here for this. So he breaks into Barry's house and gets himself some hot cocoa, looks for marshmallows, but they don't have any, and then, like, waits for Barry to come home to warn him about the whole plot going on. Like, this is the greatest scene. And he tells Iris that he reads her writing in the newspaper. Like, this is the best scene ever.
Everything. That scene was everything. I think maybe my favorite scene from this entire episode. Actually, it might even be a standout scene from the whole of The Flash this season. Like, it was just perfect. The timing down to the goddamn second was perfect. Even just thinking about it, I'm just like, don't, you're gonna have to mute yourself because you'll start laughing.
So it was great. But basically he warns Barry that the other two are out to kill him. And Barry's like, so why don't you help? And he's like, nah, I don't do pro bono work. And Barry's like, well, you keep saying you're not a hero, but you're doing kind of a crappy job of that. And he's just like, Merry Christmas, Barry, which was a great exit line.
It was fantastic. It's funny. I'm just thinking that Marimer was probably utterly delighted with this episode. Because Captain Cold and Friends is her favorite tagline for Legends. So, yeah, it did a really good job of setting him up for that series. But also, I really love him a lot. Like, he's growing on me massively as a character. I've always thought he's quite amusing, quite interesting, but this just solidified it. This one scene just made me go, yep, cool, sold, I'm yours.
Yeah, I think they've done a nice job kind of subtly building him up to where his kind of turn in Legends is believable. Like, it started last season with the fact that he figures out who Barry is and is like, I won't tell anybody if you leave me alone. Like, they kind of have a gentleman's agreement. And then we kind of see it build up in the second season where, so now he's like, you saved my sister's life and I owe you one. And it's very much, they're building up his sense of honor. So I feel like they're doing a nice, subtle job with him, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
Yeah, same. I think it's been a great character arc, and I think a lot of these shows really excel when they're digging into characters in this really subtle, nuanced way, and it's been one of the most successful ones, I think, character arcs. I really enjoyed it, and I really can't wait to see him when he moves across to Legends and we get to really, really dig into his character some more, and yeah, I've really enjoyed it.
Awesome. So kind of the other big thing going on this episode is Patty, because she tells Joe in the first episode this season that she wants to join the anti-metahuman task force because Mark Martin killed her father before he even got powers. He robbed a bank and her father was there and he got shot and died. So she has this unresolved issue with him. So he comes back on the scene and she just loses it. She tracks him when the trickster is like, hey, Flash, come get me. She tracks him down the same way that the Star Labs team tracks him down and shows up the same time the Flash does. And they almost get killed. But she kind of reveals to the Flash that she was supposed to be there in the bank that day, but she had skipped out on her job at her father's little shoe shop. So she was supposed to be taking money to the bank. Instead, her father had to do it. And that's why he was there when Mark Martin shot it up. So she should be dead, not her father. So she has this massive amount of guilt about being alive, essentially. And so it takes her to a pretty dark place at the end, because once buried / the Flash beats everybody, she comes and basically is ready to shoot Mark Martin, and the Flash has to talk her down, which he does. But it's kind of interesting to see how she's been hiding all this pain under that smile that she so much wears. And Caitlin makes a great comment that it's so weird saying character name who has my name, but she says that, you know, she and Barry are very similar like that, which I thought was interesting and kind of shows maybe a reason that they get along quite well. But how did you feel about her arc through this episode?
I loved it. I thought it was really interesting. I thought it was a great little... It was a great reveal about the character, because survivor's guilt is something that a lot of people deal with, especially when you're in stuff like maybe the armed forces or you're part of like a police department and stuff like that. And especially within the superhero genre, survivor's guilt is also something that they deal with quite a lot with certain characters. That we're seeing it with Patty prior to any of that. And that, it was so powerful. And again, it's those quiet moments that what a character is behind what you see on the surface. And sometimes the biggest smiles hide the deepest heartbreak. And it was really illustrated well here. And yeah, I think Caitlin drawing that parallel between Patty and Barry was quite an apt statement, I thought, as well, because Barry feels so deeply, and when he can't save everyone, he feels it keenly all the time, like it's his sole responsibility. So drawing that parallel between the two of them and why maybe they're connecting on such a deep level, because you look at them, on the surface, their demeanor is very cheerful, very upbeat, very optimistic in some ways, and then underneath that all, they're hiding this kind of huge responsibility that they feel for other people and the fates of other people. I just thought it was really well done. I loved it.
Did you watch the deleted scene of Barry and Patty?
I have not watched the deleted scene yet. I need to go and watch it. Caitlin linked me to the deleted scene.
Chantal Van Staten and Grant Gustin retweeted her, but tweeted a link to this. But there's a great deleted scene from this episode of Barry and Patty. They're in Barry's bedroom. They've just clearly had sex. And they're just really bantering, and they're very adorable. They have this wonderful, easy dynamic between each other. And Patty sees the picture with a young Barry with his mother, and they kind of she tells Barry that her father had died when she was a bit younger, and they kind of talk about that. And then they have this cute scene where Patty's like, I want ice cream. So Barry like pretends they have some downstairs, and he runs to a store and brings some back. It's just, they're precious. And it's he ends kind of inviting Patty to the Christmas Eve thing that the episode ends with, but it's really adorable and shows how what their dynamic is like that we haven't seen. And it shows how far their relationship has gotten, more than some of the stuff we've seen. But it's really delightful, and I recommend going to see it. If you go to Grant Gustin's Twitter, he retweeted a link to it, but it's delightful, and I love them as a couple. I think they're precious.
I need to see this now. Oh, I should have made it my priority when I got home from work, because I need it.
It's really adorable. They're very teasing to each other. It's just, it's really wonderful. So I recommend checking that out.
I'm going to. As soon as we're done recording. So.
Yeah, so it's really great. But they're the not the only cute couple of this episode. Jay and Caitlin. Oh my God. Jay keeps teasing Caitlin about Christmas, being like, what's Christmas? What's mistletoe? Like, and so she's having to come up with these explanations, assuming they don't have it on Earth too, and they're awkward science-y explanations. And then he's like, I'm teasing, we have that too. Like, it's very adorable. And Cisco is back, fresh off his breakup with Kendra, being like, oh my God, get a room. He has this great line where he's like, the thirst is real.
The thirst is real is like the perfect. It was just so great. It was like, Cisco, bow down to your perfect timing and your perfect lines. Because, yeah. But the ship is sailing. The ship is sailing so hard.
They're precious. They are kind of perfect for each other. I love it. And when they finally do kiss at the Christmas party, like, everybody in the room is like, aww, it's so cute. And I just loved them. And I don't know how they're going to deal with the fact that he is from a parallel Earth. So,
Jay, just stay.
I know.
Stay, Jay. Don't go.
I just want him to stay.
Yeah. But
those two are precious, and I loved them in this episode.
Agreed. I'm really, really liking that dynamic between the two of them. I'm into it. I ship it. The thirst is real for this ship. Please keep bringing it. Please, more of this stuff.
And we had a reveal in this episode as well. Iris tells Joe about Francine being pregnant and that she has a brother named Wally. So I guess they're not going to go down the whole she was having an affair route or anything. They're just going with she was pregnant with Joe's child, which, okay, whatever. But so Joe has to deal with it for a while. He has this really heartbreaking scene where he is feeling this guilt about not looking harder for Francine after she disappeared, and how his son that he didn't even know he had grew up without a father now. But after a while, he kind of comes to the conclusion that he wants this kid in his life. And at the very end, Wally arrives at their Christmas party and they invite him in. So Wally is here! Kid Flash, the future Flash,
yes,
is here.
So ready for this to happen. Just, I can't wait. I can't wait to see him integrating. I can't wait to see how he deals with characters like Barry. I can't wait to see how he, like, just fits in with the rest of the show. I'm here for it. I'm ready. Bring it on!
There was an interview with Keenan Lonsdale, who was playing Wally, after the episode, and he talks a little bit about what they can expect. I wrote up a Who is Wally article, and there's some quotes in there you can read on Hypeable. But, well, he says that he's into drag racing, so that's going to be a bit of complication with having a cop father and a reporter sister now. And he's kind of serious because he's dealing with the fact that his mother is dying. But he also says that Wally has kind of a dry sense of humor, so he's not going to be quite as lighthearted as Wally you might be familiar with from other mediums. But maybe as things move on, he'll get there eventually. It's just kind of a depressing situation his life is in at the moment. But he's also going to have kind of a sibling rivalry with Barry. Not for anything Barry does, but just sort of like, Joe already has this kid and this kid isn't even my blood, so he doesn't really know what to do with it. And he's kind of a defensive person, so he's going to have a hard time letting people in. So it sounds like it'll be real interesting.
Yeah, I'm ready for, like, sibling rivalry between Wally and Barry, I'm not going to lie. I think that'll be be quite interesting, so.
Oh, yeah, and this came on the heels of Joe giving Barry his watch.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
That moment. Holy crap. Oh, this family. I can't deal with them.
Oh, it was very enjoyable. Lots of emotional stuff, but generally enjoyable episode. The whole weather wizard trickster thing gets solved with some wibbly wobbly sciency wyancy stuff where they send a bunch of bombs into a breach in the sky and they might have just blown up another Earth, but oh well.
Hey, at least it's not theirs.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, any other thoughts on The Flash?
No, we are good to move on.
All right, Arrow?
Yeah.
All right, so I feel like my theme for this episode is Damian Dark is the best. Like, I feel like he's the best villain they have had yet on this show. And Slade was a great villain, but I feel like Damian Dark is just evil, and I love him. He's got this, he's so scary in a way that they couldn't make Roz for some reason. Like, he seems to have genuine motivations, though we don't quite know what they are yet, and he makes threats and then he isn't idle about them, and if someone threatens him, as Oliver does in this episode, he retaliates. So I just feel like he's such a good villain, and Neil McDonough is killing it in this part.
Yeah, no, the threat of Damian Dark is looming and massive and all-encompassing to this show. Like, it's real. The thing with a lot of the bad guys sometimes is that they'll make a threat and it'll just fizzle out somewhere, or it's just really easy to brush to one side and it doesn't really go anywhere. The thing with Damian Dark is that he makes those threats and he genuinely follows through on them. A lot of the threats that he's made have come true. And that's the scary part, is that he is efficient. He has a plan. He's sticking to it. We don't know what the plan is, but he's clearly working his way there. And the other thing is that he's got this genuine charisma to him as well that makes you feel terrible sometimes for enjoying him as a character, even though he's, like, despicable, like, unescapably evil. But there's something magnetic about him that just draws you in. And I find myself getting lost in him as a character. And then I'm just like, whoa. Okay, step back a little bit, because he is terrible. He's great, but he's terrible.
Yeah, and we see at the end of this episode, he's visiting his family. Looks like a wife and daughter. And he told Quentin that he has a child. He said, like, from one father to another back when Sarah was revived. But that was interesting. So Damian Dark is also a family man.
Yeah, it's that scary kind of parallel of, like, wondering what he's like as a father in his home life versus what he's doing as a villain. I'd be looking forward to seeing how they develop and explore that, because I think it would be interesting to see if there's, like, a genuine difference in his demeanor depending on how he feels about someone, if there's, like, genuine love and affection there. Like, that, I think that'll be quite interesting to explore with him as a character. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out, if we see it play out, it's almost guaranteed that they will, considering how much focus there's been on Damian Dark this season.
Yep. So another thing with Hive is that we kind of get a reveal of what they've been working on. We know that they have this kind of plan that they've been calling Genesis, and their stage 3 ends up being like this massive bunker of living corn stalks. So I have no idea what they're planning.
I don't know either. I got really weird flashbacks to that terrible M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Happening. It's like, it's the wind. And it's like, oh God, please don't go down some really weird route with this, because I don't... Corn? Really? What the hell is going on? What is going on?
We know they want to let the city die, and then they have a lot of corn that they managed to synthesize. They say that they synthesized it from algae from the bay, so that tells us why they attacked the bay cleanup, that they want it as is, because it's helping them grow their massive amounts of corn. but
I guess they need to finance themselves somehow.
Or maybe they're trying to be, like, underground self-sufficient or something.
I don't know, but I'm just imagining them at, like, farmer's market selling corn.
The hive stand at the farmer's market. Oh, that's great. But yeah, so zero idea what's going on there, but there's development in whatever plan they have, and we'll have to wait and see what goes on. But as we hinted at, Hive kind of opens the episode by attacking this volunteer cleanup that the Queen campaign is running, and Oliver is just fed up, and he meant it when he said that we are going to fight Damien Dark in the light. All the dark puns are just amazing with the character, but so he basically reveals to the media, here's a picture of Damien Dark. He runs an organization called Hive. They're the ghosts. Dun, dun, dun. And Damien's like, not cool, man. Not cool. So did you think that was a smart thing for Oliver to do?
I don't know about smart, because, I mean, it's definitely painted a target on his back, as we see with how Damien Dark retaliates in this episode, but it was very Oliver, I think, for how he's developing in this season. So dragging Damien Dark to a point where he can't manipulate things in the background anymore in a way that's easier for him to continue to hide and to continue to, I guess, keep that side of him in the shadows a little bit. Like, that's upset potentially some of Damien Dark's plans, which in that respect is smart. The fact that he's backing a very dangerous character into a corner, maybe not so smart. But, you know, sometimes Oliver doesn't think about he doesn't think too far into the future sometimes.
And he has the support of everybody else on the team. They're like, let's do it. We don't really know what else to do at this point, so.
Yeah, it's kind of like they're backed into a corner, so they figure, let's just back him into a corner as well. So I don't know really how smart the decision is, but it kind of upsets the balance, the power balance a little bit, which, you know, puts them a little bit more on equal footing, which at this point was about all that they could ask for.
Yeah, so as we mentioned earlier, Damien Dark does not take threats to him lying down, so he retaliates by interrupting the Queen holiday party. He makes sure to say it's a holiday party because Felicity is Jewish. And then Damien Dark arrives and kidnaps Felicity, Thea, and Diggle because those are the people that Oliver cares about. They don't take Laurel because she wasn't there. She was manning a hotline of people calling with potential information about Damien Dark. So she's not there, luckily. But Hive takes those three and leads to a pretty kick-ass rescue mission with Laurel and Malcolm, of all people. But I guess because Thea is there, he's going after Thea. And Malcolm dons the Green Arrow costume, which I was like, heresy. But so Malcolm and Laurel arrive and help rescue Felicity, Thea, and Diggle before Damien Dark puts them in a gas chamber, especially the Jewish character in a gas chamber after he's just talked about the Nazis. Like, dear Lord.
Yeah, that was a little bit close to the bone, almost. But the rescue mission was really awesome, I thought. Laurel is a character that I'm really enjoying more and more and more. Like, I was really worried about her becoming a Black Canary as early as she did. But I think it's worked out really well for the character. It's really pushed her in a direction that I'm enjoying more, and I'm enjoying her more as a character. And so, yeah, I just really loved her through this whole rescue mission. As for Malcolm in the Green Arrow costume, it made my hair stand on end, but then when I stopped to think of it logically, I was like, well, what other option did they realistically have at that point for who could should pretend to be Oliver, because obviously Diggle, who has pretended to be Oliver previously, is not an option at that point. So,
plus Malcolm probably didn't want to reveal himself because Damian probably knew who he is.
Yes, there's also that. So it kind of just had a twofold kind of way of protecting Oliver and, I guess, protecting Malcolm, even though I don't want to ever protect Malcolm.
Never.
John Barrowman, I love you, but...
but not Malcolm.
No.
But yeah, so they rescue the team. Even Quentin gets involved, so he pretty much blows his cover with the group because he brings in some reinforcements. But he and Laurel have this great conversation about Quentin not wanting her to go out, and she's like, you know, you don't get to decide that I need protection. It's a really great moment, and it kind of parallels to a conversation that Oliver and Felicity have where she's like, you don't need to protect me all the time. I can decide if I need protection. So those two parallel very well in this episode. But Quentin seems like his cover is blown, so that doesn't bode well for his lifespan and kind of further cements my feeling that he's the one in the grave. And I will talk about why it's not Felicity in a minute. But I continue to worry about Quentin Lance.
I do too, and I also really love the actor, so please don't make him out of a job. I really like him.
Oh yeah, and Felicity discovers that he and her mom are dating.
Oh my god, yes.
And Dawn is like, wait, you know each other? And Felicity's like, I need to hit my head with something heavy to forget this.
It's adorable, though.
It was great. Yeah. I liked that little moment. But yeah, so kind of the other big thing in this episode is it's all Felicity all the time. Felicity finds out that Oliver was going to propose because Oliver was dumb and hid the ring where it could be found, and Mama Smoke is decorating and finds it in the decorations. So she's like, Felicity, he was going to propose. And Felicity's eyes do this thing where they like cross downward, and it's hilarious, like her reaction when she realizes. And then at the party, she talking to, we met Curtis's husband, by the way.
That was wonderful. I loved that. It was great.
But Felicity kind of asks about, you know, their wedding, and he mentions, like, his proposal, and that makes Felicity go, like, he's like, we didn't do what straight people do by putting it in dessert, because he would have eaten it or something like that, which is hilarious. But then Felicity was like, oh my god, souffle. He was going to propose that day that Thea and Laurel showed up. So she was like, holy crap, he was going to propose, and she confronts him about it. He's like, yes, I was. But then things changed and there's some upheaval because she's like, wait, did you change your mind or something? Like, why didn't you once we had settled? But they can't finish the conversation because that's when Damian Dark shows up. But after the rescue mission and everything, they have this whole like unity thing, and Oliver's lighting a tree at the bay and all this stuff. And he has this public proposal where he's like, you are the light, which, you know, again, the darkness,
yeah,
of dark. But so he proposes and Felicity accepts, and it's a really sweet moment, and so naturally something horrible has to happen. So the two, kind of in a stupid move, drive off by themselves. Like, crazy guy is after you and you go off in a limo on your own, like, not smart.
Yeah.
But they drive off, and then they get, their limo is surrounded by ghosts, and the ghosts shoot him up, and their driver killed, and he'll probably never be mentioned again. So RIP random driver. But Oliver gets the car out and tries to find Felicity has been shot, and she is unconscious. So I'm just saying, she's not dead, people. At least if she's in the grave, it's not from this. The timelines don't match up. That was 6 months after the season premiere. It's only been 2 months in Showtime, because that was October. It's Christmas. So it's been, we have like another 4 months to go.
Yeah. So,
plus, it's just really obvious. They're like, if you watch the promo, they're like playing up the grave footage. It's too obvious. The Arrow writers like to shake things up and throw like twists and turns in their twists and turns. So it's way too obvious. They're playing it up to freak you out, and it's not. She's going to be fine. They might even fake her death, We don't know, but
yeah,
she's not in the grave.
No, she's not. And the timing for a headstone for a grave for someone of a Jewish denomination doesn't fit the timeline either.
And plus, Barry's reaction to it
would be far more devastated.
He would not miss the funeral for anything. I don't think even Zoom attacking could stop him from missing Felicity's funeral. And he was not all that upset at the after funeral when he shows up. He was very much more like, I'm here for you, Oliver. But if it were Felicity, we know how close Barry and Felicity are, he would be visibly more upset. So,
guys, devastated.
It's not Felicity.
It's massive red herring fake out. I don't buy it for a second. She's going to be fine. But I don't even, not even for a second did I buy the, like, even from that promo, I was just like, oh, really?
You're like, gonna you really try want and push us to this? Believe that? Yeah.
I'm not gonna believe it. So, no. It's a nice try, but no.
I mean, maybe she'll be hurt in some way, but it's not her. Plus, Emily Bette Ricards has been filming, so...
Yeah.
It's not her.
Yeah.
At least, or maybe she is in the grave, but the tomb, the headstone part doesn't work, but it's not from this. So we still got another, like, 4 months to go in Showtime before we find out who's in the grave. So I still think it's Quentin, personally.
Yeah, but I don't think it's Felicity at all.
It's not. It doesn't work. The time doesn't work. So anyone who's freaking out, it's not Felicity. We promise.
And if it does end up being Felicity, you can come back and shout at us for being
It's not Felicity from this shooting. She could be killed later in, like, the season finale or something, but...
Nah, I don't buy that either.
That doesn't really work with the other things we've talked about either. So we're, like, we're 100% sure she's not in the grave from this shooting, and we're, like, 99.8% sure she's not, period.
Yeah, so don't worry, guys.
So, happiness turns into sadness, and that's sort of the definition of Arrow. So.
Yeah.
It is what it is. Any other thoughts on this one?
No, we're all good. We can move on to the last mid-season finale that we got for this week, and that was Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So, obviously picking up right where the previous episode left off, where Coulson decides to skydive through the portal onto the planet and knocks himself out. Good going there, Coulson. So, we pick right up with, like, Mac and everyone trying to figure out what to do next. So... The thing with Mac is that in this episode, he manages to do what Coulson has been struggling to do for 2 seasons. And that is to run a cohesive team that works together and gets stuff done. I've not seen the team work as well as it did in this episode since pre the Winter Soldier reveal. Like, that's how gelled and well these guys all work together from start to finish. And I was incredibly impressed with Mac in this episode, and I want him to stay as a director because I feel like he settled into the role far easier and far more naturally than Coulson did. I think Coulson is more suited to a field agent, but I really, really loved it, and I loved them coming up with a plan together to get into the castle and to secure the portal and to save, at that point, Fitz and or Simmons, because they couldn't figure out from, like, the sort of heat map that they had which one had gone through the portal with Ward. So, yeah, I really, really loved it. How did you feel seeing Mac in action as director?
I loved it, and I was terrified they were going to kill him. Like, he's like, I'll stay behind and be the leader, and I was like, oh god, are they gonna kill another person of color in their mid-season finale? Like, do not do that. I was so terrified they were gonna kill him. Like, one sane man, do not kill Mac. And thankfully they didn't, but he was great. And there was the moment where, like, everyone was making plans kind of in the face of what he wanted them to do, and he just stops them. So you can, he's got the gravitas to get everyone to listen to him, and they respect him enough to go with his orders. And I think that's really important.
It's incredibly important for running an organization, especially one that is still as fractured as S.H.I.E.L.D. is. Like, so much changes all of the time in this show. Like, they shake up the entire entire Foundation. Obviously, Quake puns unintended here. They do shake up the foundations of this show fairly often to fit in with the wider cinematic universe to keep it on track with that trajectory. And so basically, it just kind of, it was nice to see someone completely in control for once, and to basically be like, look, no matter what happens, this is what we need to do, this is how we're going to do it. And the thing with Coulson is that he's easily swayed, depending on the person, to like change his plans up rather than sometimes sticking with his gut and executing a plan the way that he thinks it needs to be executed. And I think Max staying really strong in the face of like a lot of other really strong personalities that have a lot of really emotional investment in what's going on here, and just being like, we're taking all of that out of consideration, and all there is the mission, and down to the line, this is what we're going to do. And he just kept control of it from start to finish, and I was so impressed with him. And I don't know, I want to see more of that development of his character, because I think it's where he shines best. I don't think he was utilized in the best way in season 2, and I flip-flopped on him a lot in season 2. Like, sometimes I thought they were going in a really great direction with him, i.e. when he and Fitz were interacting in season 2. And then, you know, with the whole Gonzalez thing and all of that, I kind of like went through a bumpy bit with him. And I think this is a really nice track to have him on, and I hope they do explore it a lot more, because I think he realized the skills of each individual person and placed them at the best possible point in order to utilize those skills and execute a mission in the most successful way. And I was just incredibly impressed with him.
Go Mac.
Basically, yeah, team Mac as director, 5 ever.
Exactly.
But back on the other side of the portal, Ward is basically corralling Fitz and the rest of his Hydra team to figure out where this creature is, this ominous inhuman who is terribly powerful and terribly frightening. And Fitz leads them on a merry chase, even after he gets clocked around the head pretty awfully, and goes tumbling down some places when he tries to steal Ward's gun, which, nice try, Fitz, but nice try. Eventually, he ends up leading them straight to Will, who is injured pretty badly when we initially discover him, and we later find out that he actually died. So as they're kind of like marching back through to get back to the portal after Will helps Fitz take out all of like the Hydra agents, and they manage to like separate off from Ward. Yeah, it is revealed that Will died, and it, which is what they're referring to as this creature, took over his body, and he is now possessing Will. So how did you feel about that reveal?
I didn't like it. I kind of felt like it was a cop-out on the writer's part, that they didn't want to explore the potentially complicated relationship that would exist if Will was alive and they brought him back to Earth. So it felt a little bit like he was killed off for the sake of the Fitzsimmons ship that has recently launched. It just felt kind of lazy to me. I didn't like it all that much.
I disagree slightly that he died for the sake of Fitzsimmons as a ship. Even though we got that emotional kind of, where they kind of come back together after the whole mission, and Fitz and Simmons like hug after she realizes that Will isn't coming back and she's utterly devastated. But I don't know. I don't feel that it was necessarily for the sake of Fitzsimmons launching as a ship. I don't know if after everything that both of these characters went through in this episode, that they'll find themselves on the footing to be able to move along in that relationship. Because obviously, Gemma did a huge altering thing for her character in this episode when she releases Andrew, and Andrew goes on to kill all of the Inhumans that were being held captive. And while in her defense for that, you know, she was between a rock and a hard place of what she could potentially do in order to save herself, that's still going to weigh really heavily on her as a character. Whereas on Fitz's side, even though this Inhuman was possessing Will when he killed him, that's gonna weigh really heavily on him. So I feel like there's still this real big complication of guilt and really heavy emotions that are still left to explore between them that may put the brakes on a relationship still. It just makes it complicated in a different way, personally. So yeah, that's how I felt about it.
I mean, I kind of stand by how I feel.
Which is fair enough.
That's how it came across. Like, they set up this really fascinating potential dynamic, and they were doing some interesting things with how Fitz and Simmons were reacting to Will's existence, basically. And then it just sort of feels like that all is cut off at the knees by killing him, basically.
Yeah, I just think that there's more complications and complicated emotions that can come out of this based on what each character had to do to survive. You know, in respect to both characters, what they do is in order to survive and get back to each other. But for Fitz, you know, that's going to weigh heavily on him, because regardless of who was in that body, it still wore the face of Will. And for Simmons, even though it was potentially the only decision that she could make at that particular time, those deaths, she's still going to feel them weighing heavily on her shoulders. So I just think it's going to be complicated in a different way, and I'm interested to see how that plays out. But basically, after Fitz kills Will, we basically get this huge, massive final showdown between Coulson and Ward. So after Will and Fitz split off from Ward and the other Hydra agents, Coulson kind of stumbles on Ward and shoots him, and kind of like holds him at gunpoint as they try to get back to the portal. And it culminates essentially in Coulson getting the upper hand on him, knocking him unconscious while the portal reopens. And you've got Fitz shouting at him that they have to go, they have to get into the portal, it's closing. And you have Coulson standing over Ward and Fitz shouting at him to leave Ward, and Coulson kills him. And I didn't think that they would ever go there with this storyline. I didn't think we would ever see Ward actually die in this respect. Yes, okay, he technically comes back because the creature then possesses Ward, but it was the line that Coulson has crossed here puts me a little bit in doubt with how far his character is going to, like, swing to, like, maybe a darker side of him, because it was very, very personally motivated, what he did. And for me, I think when he takes off his hand and throws it down and walks away, I think in his mind he's basically being like, that's it, it's over, it's done, I've crossed that line, and that's it. But there's a very, very fine line between how Coulson has acted here and how Ward has previously acted that could swing either way for the characters. So how did you feel about this whole storyline with Coulson culminating in him killing Ward, and then obviously what happens with Ward by the end?
My feelings on Ward are abundantly clear, and yet I didn't find it nearly as satisfying as I would have liked, because like you, I didn't think they'd ever actually kill him. So I was like, clearly this is not going to last. Maybe somehow this will trigger his transformation into an Inhuman or something. So I was sitting there going, oh, well, I'm glad he's dead. Too bad he's not going to stay dead. So it sort of lost any emotional impact. I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that, no, actually he's dead because the creature is possessing him now. So the fact that Ward came back, it's not actually Ward who came back. So that's interesting. But I didn't have the emotional response that I wanted, because the stake didn't feel like it was there. And I was still so frustrated with the route they took to get there in the first place. So I just, and it was kind of like smacking you in the face with the whole like Rosalind dream that Coulson has on the planet. And I was just, I'm still so bothered by it that I have a hard time connecting to and feeling any satisfaction from it.
Yeah, the thing that really bothered me the most about Ward's death is that he kills him when he's unconscious. There's something inherently awful about that. And I mean, yes, Ward is a terrible, awful character who's done terrible, awful things to so many people. But it just, there was something about it that set me on edge a little bit. It made me feel uncomfortable. Like, it's kind of that, like sometimes you get those heroes who will say, you know, if I ever kill you, you'll be facing me and you'll be armed. Wait, that's Firefly, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
That is Firefly. I'm just like there going, oh God, I'm going Malcolm Reynolds on this thing. Yeah, it's that, you know, when, like, if and when I kill you, you'll be facing me and you'll be armed. Like, that's, yes, he had a chance to defend himself, but there was something about killing him when he was unconscious that just made me feel really uneasy.
Was he unconscious? I thought his eyes were open.
No, he was definitely, like, he incapacitated him. I thought he was unconscious.
I thought he was incapacitated but conscious.
Oh, I didn't think he was conscious. Maybe I need to rewatch the episode, but, like, I read that he was unconscious at that point.
I mean, I have a distinct memory of his eyes being really wide as Coulson was pushing his hand down on his chest.
Maybe I watched a really bad stream because the picture quality wasn't amazing, so maybe I missed that, but I thought he was unconscious. Potentially I need to rewatch the episode because that was something from my reading that just felt a little, made me a little bit uneasy. But anyway, yeah, he, in body, in face, Ward comes back by the end, but he is not Grant Ward anymore. So Grant Ward, as we know him, or as we knew him, is dead. That's it. He's not coming back. He is now just it. So it just felt, there was something slightly anticlimactic about it.
That's the word I would use, too. That's
yeah.
What I was thinking.
It just, yeah. I don't know how I feel about it. I think it set up the back half of this season in a very interesting way in terms of character motivations and where they'll go next and what'll happen next with them and with their relationships and how this inhuman creature, now that he's reunited with Hydra, how that's going to work out. And obviously Andrew's on the loose again, so you've got the double threat of two really powerful forces working and being like really threatening. So it's got a really interesting trajectory for the back half of this season, but you know, it was a very quiet mid-season finale for me. Yes, some fairly substantial things happened, but I think it was all more in the interests of setting up what comes next rather than having like this big impact. And I'm still on the fence about how successful that was. I think it'll really help with the back half of the season and seeing how that plays out for how the last couple of episodes fit into it. I think this was the feeling that I get with these episodes, I think, might change once we see the bigger picture in the second half of the season. So, yeah, I think it'll be interesting when it comes back after the break.
Yeah, I think how whatever comes from this will be important in shaping how I end up feeling about it. But
yeah.
As of right now, I'm not thrilled.
Yeah, I think it was just, compared to the other mid-season finales, it was quieter. And for now, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I want to see what this means for the rest of the season. And that's going to inform how I feel about these episodes. I think this season is going to be really interesting to watch once it's all done. Because I think these quieter episodes building up to something like this may be more impactful once the rest of the season plays out. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to the back half, personally, just to see what this means for the show. Do you have anything else that you would like to add for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Just that I hope my rage dissipates before it comes back from these last two episodes.
Well, hopefully Agent Carter will be a soothing balm for you during the break.
Yes, give me Peggy!
Yeah. that soon, but delayed. Soon, but still delayed. But hey, we're still getting her, which is the important part.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so let's get through some movie headlines. Not a massive amount, just a couple of really brief things. So firstly, Kate Blanchett is in talks to play an unknown role in Thor Ragnarok. Really love Kate Blanchett. I think she's a great actress. Hero or villain, I think would be quite interesting. Honestly, I'd love to see her as some kind of Valkyrie character or Norse kind of warrior character. So I think she'd fit particularly well with that. But at the moment, we don't know what role she's up for.
Fun fact, Kate Blanchett and I are birthday twins.
Oh, that's really cool. one of my birthday twins, for anyone who's a Teen Wolf fan, is Jeff Davis, the showrunner of Teen Wolf.
That may be good or bad.
Hey, I would say good. I like whatever other people think of Jeff Davis. I love the guy. I think he's wonderful. But yeah, he's my birthday twin. We also got a little featurette for Captain America Civil War, which didn't give us a lot of new footage. It gave us some little bits behind the scenes. You know, you can obsessively watch and rewatch this, but the majority it was made up of, like, footage from previous films. But it was basically being all like, nothing's gonna be the same again. And we got to see, we got like a tiny bit more about Black Panther. And we got to see a little bit more of Scarlet Witch, which was quite cool. Did you watch this clip?
I did. And I was zeroing in every time there was a little bit of Bucky, but there wasn't as much in this one.
No, I think it focused on some more of the characters that we didn't see as much of in the actual trailer. But it's basically they were reaffirming that it's going to challenge the way that we think about all of the characters. So Tony Stark, Steve Rogers, you know, your alliances when you go into the movie aren't going to be what you think they might be coming out of it. So yeah, it's a really interesting little featurette that I would recommend giving a watch. And I guess the other bit of Civil War news that we got was that the Russo brothers basically were like, Spider-Man was always part of the film story. They're like, we totally told Marvel that we had a plan B, but there was never a plan B, which I thought was hilarious. Sure. And just like the Russo brothers, funnily enough, I just thought it was really, really funny that they were like, yeah, there was never a plan B, which I thought was quite funny. The only other Marvel bit of news that we've got is that we may finally be getting our director for Black Panther. So Ryan Coogler might be taking the reins. But at the moment, that's just a rumor. There's no substantiated evidence for that yet. So, you know, lots of names keep getting thrown around. But, you know, I think he would be an interesting choice. He had a lot of good things about some of his movies, so yeah.
It's like Wonder Woman. The more you hear about the movie, the more likely that they can't cancel it. So
yeah,
the closer we get to a director, the more likely the movie is to happen.
Exactly. But as far as the Marvel side of movie news, that was about it.
Moving on to Fox, they pulled their own Beyonce and dropped the trailer for X-Men Apocalypse today. So we waited till just the right time to record because we got the trailer this morning. We thought we'd be waiting until Star Wars, and we got it a little bit early. So we got a full trailer for X-Men Apocalypse, and Danya had some thoughts.
I did have some thoughts. I am not overly impressed with this trailer. And I think the majority of that is based on the fact that the visual effects are abysmal. Like, they are really, really bad. And the thing is that having been involved in animation and being really up on visual effects, it stands out so badly for me that it was so distracting. So I'm hoping that this is just trailer effects and it's not, like, it's really not what we're gonna see finalized in the movie, because that's really worrying. And the other thing, Apocalypse wasn't really threatening to me. Like, he just came across, like, I don't know what it is with Power Rangers villains right now, but he came across like another over-the-top Power Rangers villain. And, like I've said previously, nothing against Power Rangers villains in the right setting, but this isn't a Power Rangers movie. So I'm a little bit concerned about how much of a threat I'm gonna feel Apocalypse is. He wasn't as imposing as I thought he was going to be. He wasn't as terrifying a presence as they were trying to make the characters make us think he was. Like, the whole thing with Charles being like, I've never felt a power like this before. And I'm like, they're going, really? That short fry? Are you kidding me? Like, he's tiny compared to, like, some of the other characters. And that's, if you're not going to make him imposing in stature, at least make him imposing in, like, his presence. But I just didn't feel that at all. I will say, however, things I loved. Little glance at Jean Grey. Storm looked phenomenal. Loved Jubilee. And that final shot of Charles Xavier with him being bald and the sort of shadows cast over him, I got a little shiver up my spine at that shot. But on the whole, for me, an underwhelming trailer. How about you? How did you feel about it?
I have less connection to this material than you did, so I thought it was pretty much fine. I do agree that Apocalypse seems a little underwhelming. I would expect him to be a bit more imposing for the way they're building him up to be this ancient evil that even the Bible is borrowing from. But overall, I thought it was fun. I didn't actually notice the special effects being terrible, so I don't know if it's just because I watched Once Upon a Time, so I'm sort of not fazed by that anymore, but that didn't really bother me. I was intrigued, and I am still looking forward to the movie.
Yeah, I think I'm still looking forward to the movie. I'm hoping that in the context of the film, Apocalypse is going to be more threatening, but for a lot of this, I felt it was a lot more tell than show. I just didn't feel it. I didn't feel that threat. I didn't feel scared of Apocalypse, which, as the father of all mutants and the most powerful and the scariest mutant that there is, you know, I would expect that.
We've still got time.
We do. There were little glimpses that keep me hopeful for this movie, so I'm hoping that potentially a second trailer might be more refined, and especially in the special effects side of things, and maybe in the actual threat of Apocalypse, showing it rather than having the characters tell us, like, you should be scared of this guy. Like, don't play that game with me. Telling me something isn't going to make me afraid. Showing it is. So.
But we do need to keep in mind these trailers are for especially the more general audience, so they need to know, like, who this is.
Yeah.
Basically, why do we care? Because he is the father of all mutants. We need to tell you this. And then in future trailers, we can more think about maybe emotional aspects of it.
Yeah. I think, again, this is where me having as strong a background in comics is my downfall, because when we do get these kind of trailers, they end up being really underwhelming and worrying for me. And so, yeah, I'll hold out, because otherwise some of the looks of some of the characters were really, really impressive, and I'd like to see more of it.
All right, so our last bit of news, just tiny little thing, this is on the DC side, that basically, the Batman v Superman trailer is not getting nearly as many views as the Civil War trailer, which was released a little bit before it, which I don't know if that surprises anybody, but the trailer took in 60 million views in the first 24 hours, and Batman v Superman only got 23 million. And the previous Batman v Superman trailer took in over 30 million views, so its views are down on the downturn a little bit, so.
I mean, regardless of my feelings about 50 Shades of Batman versus Superman, you know, you have to think as well in regards to how long the Comic-Con trailer's been out. Yes, there is going to be a discrepancy in the views because the Comic-Con trailer's been out a little bit longer, so it's had enough time to amass more views. So I'm not too worried about the discrepancy in numbers.
Well, that was in
the
first
two.
24 hours.
Exactly. Just. So, you know, the thing with the Marvel trailers as well is that the Marvel marketing is so well done that there's more hysteria around it. And the thing with it is, as well, is that there's this huge built-up expanded universe behind it as a driving force. We're already invested in these characters heavily. We already know them. We already have our favorites. We already have this kind of huge connection to this story because it's been going on for so long, since Iron Man. You know, this has been the build-up since Iron Man. Whereas with Batman vs. Superman, this is basically the beginning for their expanded universe. So I think it's a little bit unfair comparing where each of these franchises is at this particular point in terms of trailer views. I think it's slightly unfair because the investment is obviously going to be more on Marvel's side with this because we've had these characters for longer. So I think as more people see more of these DC movies, you'll start to see, like, the cumulative trailer views going up. So, I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily an indicator of how successful Batman vs. Superman is going to be based on those views. So
it's going to make a ton of money.
No? Oh, yeah.
People just like to throw the comparisons out there since they're coming out so close together. So
yeah.
And there it is.
Yeah, yeah. Let's move on to our quotes of the week, seeing as that was the last little bit of news that we had. So, Caitlin, do you want to go with yours?
Sure. Mine is from Supergirl, and it is the big reveal when Hank Henshaw says, "I am the sole survivor of my planet, the last son of Mars. My name is John Jones," as he gets all imposing. Oh, so good.
That reveal, just that reveal, man, it was just so good. So good. I was incredibly impressed. Like, I love that line, shivers. So many shivers. Oh, all the way down my spine. Ah. Oh. Perfect. Mine... Oh dear. My quote of the week comes from a screenshot that we got from the upcoming Avengers Academy game that's going to be out for mobile platforms in the new year. And it's basically like a yearbook picture kind of thing with a load of the Avengers on it. And it's got a picture of Hawkeye with a quote underneath it. And it just says, "When life gives you lemons, shoot arrows at them." And I was like, yeah, quote of the week, done. Because surprising no one. Hawkeye gets me every time. This game looks absolutely freaking ridiculous, by the way. It looks like some kind of Japanese RPG dating sim ridiculousness. And I'm here for it. I can't wait for this to come out. I hope I can be Hawkeye, because that would make my life. But also Kamala Khan is in this game. So it looks really cool. They just released like a little sneak peek and some screenshots from the game, and it looks quite cool. I'm looking forward to seeing more of it. Right, Comic Corner! And you've got a full-sized Comic Corner this week. So in honor of Wally West coming to The Flash, I've got some recommendations for comic books if you want to learn a little bit more about his origins. So first comic I've got for you guys is The Flash Born to Run. So for the best introduction possible to Wally West, then look no further than this. Born to Run is a retelling of Wally West's origin as Kid Flash and his adventures with Barry Allen. It sets Wally on the path that ultimately leads to him taking over the mantle of The Flash from Barry and strikes a perfect balance between humor and drama. Second one I've got is The Flash, The Return of Barry Allen. So don't let this title fool you. This story is as much about Wally as it is about Barry himself. When Barry returns from the dead, Wally has to confront his fears about living in Barry's shadow. With some phenomenal writing that really showcased Wally as a character, and with an epic twist, this is one that you'll want to add to your collection. And fast. Ho ho. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't help puns.
But ching!
next one I've got is The Flash Terminal Velocity. So this one is a great ensemble piece, which features more speedsters than you can probably count, but still ultimately is a story about Wally West. It's a pretty tense read, and you really feel the threat of the terrorist cell that they come up against. We won't spoil the ending, but it's a doozy. Next one I've got is The Flesh Blitz. So this is potentially the most shocking arc during Wally West's entire run, and it changed the status quo for the character in a huge way. Without giving anything specific away, expect a story about vengeance, betrayal, and tragedy, and a lot of emotions. So definitely pick this one up and add it to your collection if you are a fan of Wally West and The Flash. And finally, I've got The Flash Rogue War. So this is the final arc in Geoff Johns' time on The Flash, and it definitely ends things with a bang. It sees the original Rogues come up against the new generation of Rogues, with the city hanging in the balance. Wally and the rest of the Speedsters are caught up in the middle of their epic battle, and then Zoom returns. So that'll give you an idea of how well everything turns out, but it's a pretty great trade, so I definitely recommend that one. And that's it. So let's get into some feedback. Got quite a few comments considering I released the episode late, sorry guys, but we still got a few of you interacting with us. So Caitlin, would you like to take the first comment from Cassie?
Sure. So I think Cassie was watching Supergirl when she tweeted us and said, "Lol's Max Lord spent a year studying medicine, more like he spent a lifetime as a sparkling vampire doctor. Hashtag Supergirl." That's fair.
Yeah. And she gave us a second one as well, which I think was also while she was watching Supergirl, because like us, she just went, "Okay, WTF, James is falling to his death and Kara takes the time to rip off his civvies. Where'd they go anyways?" Where did they go indeed? Down the elevator shaft? I don't know. Someone will probably like come along later and pick them up and be like, "Did someone get naked?"
Doesn't like Superman have like a pocket in his cape and uses a string to like hide his clothes in there? That's probably what happened.
Yes, there's pockets in the cape. We also got a comment from Sarah who said, "Joe giving Barry the watch," and then it's a teary-eyed emoticon. I have so many big feelings about Barry and Joe.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
And then Sarah tweeted us again and said, "Joe, I miss Eddie too. Me, will we ever know what Earth 2 Eddie is doing? Is he happy? Is he warm?"
I was like, the is he happy? Is he warm? Like, killed me. I was like, oh, Eddie, no. We also got a comment from Susan, who said, "Snart with a reindeer mug, I died of amusement."
I love that he checked to see if they had marshmallows, and he was like, "You're out, I checked."
Oh,
I'm just picturing him, like, going around their house, like, going into Barry's room, and be like, "What do you have in here?" Like, oh, it's such a good image.
Yeah, seriously.
And then Sarah tweeted us back and said, "Two words, Felicity Smoke. Ah, but you see, I find her annoying. I don't know what it is. I just can't get into Arrow." She had said she doesn't like watching the two-parters because you have to watch both shows. And, I mean, if you're happy being wrong, then you do you, Sarah.
Come on, be fair. Like, it's not... Look, let's be real. Arrow isn't for everyone. I mean, it's, it has been a darker show than The Flash. I think The Flash has a lot going for it in terms of really solid writing from its inception. Like, I think a lot of where they took missteps with Arrow has made Flash a strong show. So, I can see... Honestly, I can see why people wouldn't like Arrow and may like The Flash instead.
But not Felicity? I mean, come on.
I know. There are a few...
Felicity's queen of my heart. I love her.
I thought Sarah Lance was queen of your heart.
I have a lot of kingdoms in my heart. Bobby Morris rules one of them. Felicity rules one of them. Sarah rules one of them. You know.
So basically what you're saying is you have a weakness for blondes.
Blondes who kick ass, I guess I do.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess... yeah. I mean, there are a lot of people. There are people out there who don't like Felicity. And I mean, that's a valid choice. You cannot like some things and you don't need to watch them. Obviously, it makes the crossovers difficult, but... You know, honestly, I think season 3's been pretty strong. So if you have given it up, Sarah, and you're thinking about maybe coming back, I think the previous season wasn't as great. Like, I flip-flopped on Felicity a little bit. I think they didn't really know what they were doing with her. It was a little bit of a mess just in general. So if you ever feel like giving it another shot, if you have given it up completely, then give this season a go. I think it's a much stronger season this season.
They've pretty much corrected everything they did wrong in season 3 basically. With season 4.
Basically. So, but obviously don't feel obligated to do that. I'm just in case you're not watching it and you have given it up, just as a heads up.
But we will continue loving on Felicity. Sorry. Mm. At least I will.
Yeah. I mean, I love Felicity, too. I just accept that not everyone's going to love every character. So, question of the week. So, we're going to keep this question of the week going until our next episode because, again, sorry for releasing that episode late, but it was, what would your first order be after Coulson names you acting director of S.H.I.E.L.D.? And considering this episode has barely been up a day, we've got two responses already, which has been awesome. So Jules says, my first order would be to have the Avengers report to me, stat, and then I'm not sure, but meeting them would be worth it.
You know what Danya would do? She would steal one of those Avengers off and never give him back.
Yeah, that's true. As long as it was 616 Hawkeye, but... Do you want to get Cassie's?
Sure. Cassie says, my first act as director of S.H.I.E.L.D. would be to find Cap and Iron Man and sit them down for some ice cream so we could solve our differences. Hashtag civil discussion. There you go.
Hashtag civil discussion is like my new favorite hashtag. Now I just want to come up with like really mundane things for like Tony and Steve to talk about and just like end it with hashtag civil discussion. Like the opposite of that Civil War meme that goes around. Oh, I think that would be great. But yes, again, we'll keep this question going into our next episode, which is only going to be for the Supergirl mid-season finale. I think we'll probably see a ramp down of news now as well, as we saw in this episode. But if you want to reply to anything that we've said in this episode, if you want to just chat to us in general, if you want to answer this question of the week, whatever, we're always there. So you can tweet us at HeroHypePodcast. You can send us an email, which is herohypepodcast@gmail.com, or leave a comment on this post when it goes up on hypeable.com. But yeah, we'll be back again for the Supergirl mid-season finale. But until then, I'm Danya.
And I'm Caitlin.
And we'll see you again in the next episode, guys. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.